afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of October 25th, 2015. This is our extra special spooky edition of Information Week Live, and I'm your spooky host, Kurt Franklin, executive editor for technical content at Information Week. Joining us around the fog-enshrouded table here in the virtual studio at Information Week Live, we have Susan Nunziata, the editorial director of Information Week. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Kurt. Great to be here.
And we have Dave Wagner, the technical editor for Community here at Information Week. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kurt.
And I am distracted because I'm watching something crash on our site right now.
You said it was going to be a spooky day.
I did indeed. There we go. Now the player seems to be working for me, and I can be reassured that everything is going along just as our tightly scripted show demands. Well, the first thing that everyone wants to know in the audience is, what costumes are we all wearing? I mean, I'm sitting here looking around the table, and I'm just amazed at the creativity shown by my fellow panel members. Dave, let's start with you. What did you come dressed as on this fine Halloween Eve?
Well, you know, Halloween is about scaring people, and the scariest costume I could possibly think of in the whole world was a Kurt Franklin costume. So I'm dressed as you, Kurt.
And might I say, you nailed it. You absolutely nailed it.
I thought the kilt was the real winner there.
Most people don't pay attention to what's going on the lower extremities here on the radio, but I'm thrilled that you have that eye for detail and pick that up.
Thank you.
Well, Susan, turning to you, what are you in costume as today here at Information Week Live?
Well, since one of my favorite pastimes is watching The Walking Dead, I decided to dress as the character Carol, who is super badass. Oh, am I allowed to say that on the air?
Walks
around in twin sets and little sweaters, and then turns into a zombie killing machine whenever she needs to. So she is my idol, and I am dressed as her today.
You know, I am impressed by the detail that you're showing there. And first, let me say that since you're the editorial director, if you say it, it is by definition okay to say on the air. And next, say that the whole badass nature of that character fits so well with your natural persona. It's a great fit, and it's a great costume to have here in the studio. Well, as for me, I don't know if any of you have seen the GE commercials with the idea, the sort of white fluffy idea that is sad and dejected, and then it becomes nurtured and colorful. I'm here as an idea. I'm my normal sort of white, shaggy, shambling mound, but with colorful things coming out of my head and off of the backside. So I'm here as hopefully a good idea, ready to take wing and fly out into the world. So there you have it. That's what we're here as. And I would encourage all of our listeners who are here with us live to let the folks in the chat room know what you are in costume as this Halloween Eve. I think it's a great thing about our industry that we all show this creativity and come dressed as our favorite things here on the eve of Halloween. It's a wonderful thing. Well, to get us into the week, one of the things I want to do real quickly, Susan, is turn to you. I know that right now, you are awfully busy, among other things, working toward the Information Week conference, which comes up at the beginning of Interop in the spring. Aside from when and where it's happening, how much can you share with us about the Information Week conference that will happen next spring?
Well, we're really excited about the way we've decided to approach things this year. So the Information Week conference, which is May 2nd and 3rd in Las Vegas, is going to be held this next year, I should say, sorry, 2016, at the Four Seasons. So it's a bit more of a posh venue than we've had in the past. And we are also tying much more closely the content of the conference itself with the Elite 100 awards that we present each year. So attendees will not only have the chance to hear from some luminaries in the tech world as part of our regular keynote and presentation series there, but we're also going to feature some of the Elite 100 winners who will be presenting case studies about their award-winning projects. And so we hope to give folks the opportunity to really learn more on-site about the many great projects that folks are working on and that, you know, they're being recognized for with our Elite 100. And to let everyone know, by the way, the process for applying for the Elite 100 is open right now. So any enterprise that is earning $250 million or more in revenue each year is qualified to apply for a chance at winning a placement on our Elite 100 list. So I will put into the chat the link for how to find out more information about that in case any of our listeners are interested. So the entry process is open until December 18th, so folks have about a month and a half to get their entry forms in, and we really are excited about what this is all going to bring to folks in 2016.
Oh, outstanding. Now, I know that I have been going back and interviewing some of our 2015 Elite 100 winners, and I've been awfully impressed with just how creative these IT groups are being in what they're doing for their organizations. And it seems like that that may be the single unifying thread that I've heard in all of them. They're just being awfully creative. This whole notion of thinking outside the box is great, but outside the box seems to be where these folks live. Is that the kind of creativity that you're hoping to see in the 2016 entries?
Absolutely. And in fact, the evaluation process that we put the entries through does score for innovation, for thinking outside the box. We're really looking to honor the folks who are taking what's available to them and doing something unique and noteworthy with it, things that really set the stage for what the future of IT is going to look like. And some of the examples from last year are wonderful, including, you know, the work that was being done by Andy Karaboutis at Biogen, where she's working very closely with her colleagues in the medical side of that organization to come up with better ways to access and share data. And in fact, she even brought colleagues that were not from IT just to exemplify how cooperative her organization is in terms of bringing together the IT side and the business side of an organization. And so we're looking for folks who are doing those kinds of things, breaking down cultural barriers, breaking down technological barriers, and just all around making the most of what the tools are that are available to them today and thinking about what the future can look like for their organizations.
Well, that sounds mighty exciting. I'm certainly looking forward to being there. And shoot, I have to be there, but I'm looking forward to it. And that's a great thing. Well, we're going to be talking a lot more about the Information Week conference in the months between now and the actual event. And we actually have some exciting things that we're going to be talking about in the not-too-distant future, because the Information Week conference is such a big deal that in many ways it can't be just confined to a couple of days in early May. So we're going to be talking about some radio stuff, some other things that will be coming up. So keep listening. This is going to be exciting stuff as we move toward the Elite 100 for 2016 and the Information Week Conference in 2016. Well, to turn to the news of this week, we usually go around the table and ask people what their favorite big stories were for the week. Now, Dave, we always end with you in the Geek End, but let's pull away from that. Let's leave our audience in suspense. Aside from whatever you've done for the Geek End, what were your favorite stories of this week? What struck you as being the big news of the week?
You know, what's interesting is maybe I've forgotten something or I missed something big, but I feel like the tech world kind of took a deep breath this week. Maybe it's Halloween. Maybe it's weeks of big announcements. But I have to say there were lots of little announcements that were interesting. But the biggest things for me were kind of on the fringe. I think the IT community was all agog about a reclining workstation and minor things like that. I happen to think that this was a really good week to sort of take stock of where we've been for the year as we're about to head into the final push for 2015. And so a lot of what I wrote about this week were those kinds of things, how to deal with your bad boss and what we can expect out of some future technologies like 3D printing. So maybe I'm wrong, but maybe I missed something big. But I thought this was a relatively quiet week. Maybe you should enlighten me.
Well, I think there was a little bit going on. Susan, what do you think? Were there any stories that really stood out to you?
Well, I think the two biggest things from my point of view this week were Oracle, the announcements that Oracle was making at Oracle Open World in terms of the play that it's going to make for attempts at cloud dominance in the enterprise applications space, as well as the enterprise storage space. And then I think more fascinating and intriguing to me was IBM's decision to acquire the Weather Company. So to me, those were kind of the standout bits of news. We also had Microsoft opening its first humongous flagship store in New York City, right on Fifth Avenue. So that was an interesting move as well on the part of Microsoft to try to get into that retail space that Apple has dominated. There's a small Microsoft store in San Francisco in the Westfield Mall that I think is a tiny microcosm of what is available to those folks in New York City who want to check that out. And I think, you know, we've also seen some interesting new developments in terms of apps that are available that are going to take advantage of new features in the iPhone 6S and also in iOS 9. So things that maximize the 3D touch experience, for example, and some of the other capabilities of iOS 9, like split screens and multitasking, are really intriguing. And while they're not, you know, the kind of stop the presses news, we're certainly seeing a lot of interest from the readers in checking these things out. So I think, you know, those were the things that stood out for me this week.
You know, I like that, and I agree that you know, IBM buying the Weather Company is a fascinating story. Talking about the evolution of that company, by that company I mean IBM. At the same time as we see another company, Dell, seeming to try their best to evolve into what IBM used to be. I think watching the trajectories of those two companies is awfully interesting. And the DMCA ruling that says that, you know, yeah, if you buy something, you can modify the code that's inside. That's huge. That is really huge. To me, it's going to be interesting to see where that comes in conflict with something that the Federal Communications Commission is pushing, in that they have told wireless access point and wireless router vendors that they would like to see those devices absolutely locked down to make sure that no one can reconfigure the code in those radio-based devices, because, they say, they don't want people who aren't licensed to do so playing with a radio-emitting device. So lots of interesting things that set up further discussions going on. And then, of course, we had the House of Representatives late yesterday, I think it was, pass their latest cybersecurity bill, which, depending upon who you talk to, is either a necessary and beautifully crafted bill that is certifying that we will be safe from all the evil in the world, or it is itself the source of much of the evil in the world and puts us all under the oppressive thumb of Big Brother for years to come.
I think that's how people perceive pretty much any bill that has anything to do with technology these days.
I'm afraid you're right. But it is interesting seeing the various people weigh in on this and trying to see where their interests lie. So it's an interesting if quiet week, because Dave, I'll agree with you. There were relatively few blockbuster announcements the way there have been in recent weeks.
Right. You know what's interesting about the DMAC ruling, in my opinion, is that I actually don't think it's going to hold. I think you're right that that there are too many stakeholders like the FCC that are going to say, well, wait a minute, this is not a good idea. So for me, it was sort of a stay tuned situation, because we've unfortunately seen this happen a lot lately with rulings. Larry and you and I talked about last week with another ruling, how with the security, how the government backed off on a ruling based on commentary from an audience, and now it's going to be another year before we have a new set of rules. I think, unfortunately, that's a common problem, because we have a lot of money in technology, we have a lot of stakeholders in technology, we have a lot of both government and major companies out there who are at odds. And so every time somebody makes any announcement at all, the response is, whoa, wait a minute, from somebody. And I think that causes all of us a lot of frustration, because we don't even know which rules are going to apply and for how long at this point.
That's very true. And now, for what it's worth, I have a more optimistic view of DMCA, because this was a case, as far as I'm concerned, where some companies were trying to use DMCA to do things that it was never designed to do. And I like the idea that they were getting slapped down for that. Here is opinion rather than fact, but I think the DMCA was an awfully poorly written bit of legislation. It just reeks in any number of directions. But in this case, one of the big instigators for this was from John Deere, the John Deere Tractor Company, which had basically told a farmer who bought their tractor that no, they wouldn't provide him with the information required to let him do repairs on his tractor. And furthermore, if he tried to figure it out, they would hold him liable under the DMCA for copyright violation. Tractors, like most other motorized vehicles these days, have become awfully software dependent. And most farmers are accustomed to doing essentially all the repair on their farm equipment themselves. So here we had John Deere running up against the farmers, and according to the Librarian of Congress, at least for the time being, the farmers win. It is going to be interesting to see if we all of a sudden get a new way push for a new Copyright Act to address these issues. It wouldn't surprise me, and unfortunately, it wouldn't surprise me if basically the wording of the next Copyright Act said that you're only renting books, that after you read it the first time, you have to turn it back in for a 5-cent deposit because it actually
right.
belongs to the publisher.
Right. But think about it from John Deere's perspective, or more importantly, I think, from, say, Ford or GM's perspective. We have seen recently large, dangerous motor vehicles hacked through software, through connections that were designed to provide data to those companies to help serve their customers, who have been turned back around on them to render those devices dangerous to the consumer. So here you have a consumer who, in all good faith, is asking for something for a good reason, but I could just as easily ask for the same thing with intentions of doing something malicious. At the same time, we're in the same general atmosphere of Volkswagen doing something wrong with software, where it would have been nice if more people had gotten to see it because they'd have probably got caught sooner. So it's a really tough situation where everybody needs to have those source codes available. They need to be able to modify them. They need to be able to look at them. At the same time, it does open up even more potential vulnerabilities and corporate espionage and all sorts of other things that I can see why, if there was a law to be used to try to slow that down, someone might try to use it for a while.
Well, I guess that my point of view is that if someone is going to be looking to hack stuff for malicious purposes, it's unlikely that the fact that doing so violates a copyright agreement is going to stop them.
True enough.
I take an extremely jaundiced view of copyright legislation and its ability to stop anyone from doing anything. I mean, I was on the front lines of watching the music industry implode in the 1990s thanks to digital distribution, and not just peer-to-peer file sharing, but the ability to make CDs easily. It used to take some work to make a vinyl record, but to pirate a CD was relatively easy. And so the rampant piracy that occurred as soon as we moved into the digital era in the music industry, before we even got to Napster and peer-to-peer file sharing, just shows that, you know, there's no amount of copyright legislation that can stop that level of rampant piracy. And the technology moves so fast and legislation moves so slowly that I don't foresee any regulation that gets passed really having a big impact, because it just simply will be too little too late. By the time it gets enacted, we will have moved on to something else.
Well, it is true, and as Kurt will attest, because he was there as well, that was basically the message of Gartner, was that the algorithms that run your business should be made available to all, and so should your data, and that will actually multiply its value rather than trying to hold it tight. I'm sure there are some exceptions, and they would say there's some exceptions, but it is true that we seem to be moving to a world where we're saying, okay, everything's available, now make business out of it.
That's the key,
isn't
it?
Where it becomes harmful is for the small creators, not the big businesses.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the small creators, Susan, because that's something that a lot of people I have talked to who began businesses on something like Etsy have mentioned, because they will do something that is creative and that they began to get some traction on, And within a couple of weeks, they will start to see items that are identical to theirs popping up on Etsy from often stores located in developing nations. And so this whole notion of protecting any kind of intellectual property while also putting it out into the public sphere is becoming more challenging. And things like 3D scanners make sure that it's going to remain challenging for a long time to come. Well, that was certainly cheerful. That was appropriately spooky for a Halloween discussion. I think that's a good thing. The other thing that I want to mention, this was actually a story that just continues to develop. I was fascinated to see that this week representatives from DJI and a couple of other drone companies have been asked to join the board or the commission that's coming up with proposals for the FAA on their drone regulation where they want to register drones. And the fact that DJI and a couple of other Chris Anderson's company is in there, to me the most interesting thing in this is going to be where the cutoff line is, at which, you know, at what size do they say, okay, below this point, it's too small to worry about, so we won't register those. Because my guess is wherever that cutoff line is, just below it, we're going to see an absolute flurry of innovation in the drone world. But I think it's interesting to see who's joining that particular party. And it's going to be fascinating over the next 3 or 4 weeks to see what comes out of that group.
I'm guessing it's going to be smaller than the blimp that was floating over Pennsylvania yesterday.
Yes. Thank goodness if we put these flying things in professional hands, nothing ever goes wrong.
Yes, as history has shown. Speaking of flying things, Google has launched, or I believe, or is about to launch, one of its wireless balloons over Indonesia to test out the delivery of wireless services through using balloons. So it'll be interesting as well to see what happens with that experiment. So someday our future may be filled with near flying objects of all shapes and sizes and speeds, depending upon what gets approved and what actually works in the real world.
Yeah.
Sorry, Kurt, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think it's fascinating that they started that in Australia in the outback. And I believe I saw a statement sometime recently where they think that within the next couple of years, they will have balloons ready and the technology ready to essentially blanket the Earth's land masses in broadband coverage based solely on their balloons.
Which makes me wonder how long it is before the first balloon is shot down by a government. but, you know, it is... I think the interesting thing here is Indonesia, right? Indonesia's thousands of islands interconnected. It presents a harder problem than practically anywhere I can think of. The outback is a different problem, but at least it's connected via landmass, right? It creates one of the hardest problems I can imagine. It's also a country which is made up of dozens of smaller ethnic groups with many religions. So creating an internet, a Wi-Fi access that bridges both physical and cultural barriers in a country like Indonesia could potentially have more impact socially than you know, wired internet, you know, buried under the ground like Google is also doing with fiber in various places. I think it's really a wonderful thing they're doing, even if in the end they make money off of it. At the start of this, I think, bringing people in far-flung places together from different backgrounds is a wonderful thing.
Susan, what do you think? Is Google and the competing service, Facebook, is getting broadband from a company like this a good thing, or should the content provider really be separate from the organization providing the pipes?
Well, you know, I struggle a little bit with it. I see Google a little differently than I see Facebook, in that Google has its hands in so many different businesses, and I guess we should start calling it Alphabet, really, that I'm sort of less troubled by that, even though obviously they dominate the world of web content with their search engines and their advertising algorithms. They're also creating, you know, mobile operating systems and all manner of other things that you could see as sort of this monolithic monopoly that might have to be broken up someday, just like the old AT&T was back in the day. But at the same time, I feel that they are among the companies that are best positioned to experiment with such things. And bringing ubiquitous internet access to the world is an important goal, even though it makes me shudder to think of the cultural impact it will have on some societies. I think it's an important goal. And so I guess I'm a little ambivalent about it. It scares me, but I also admire it and admire the ideas that are coming out of Google. Facebook, I feel, is less of a monopoly and less of a significant player, in the sense that, you know, if Facebook provides the pipes and enables its service, it's just not quite of the scale that a Google is in terms of where it has its holdings and, you know, its revenue streams coming from. So it's a little less frightening and feels a little less monolithic to me. But in an ideal world, I would like those things to be separate.
See, at this point, I'm not 100% sure I could name a company who could do this technologically that doesn't already have access to something that makes it scary.
Exactly.
So
that's the dilemma.
I'm okay with that, really. I'd kind of like it if Facebook found a way to make money off of something other than my information. You know what I mean? I like if Facebook started selling internet service, they won't have to sell me. That actually is sort of a comforting thought, you know. And let's face it, Google basically sells more information about you. What was that? I'm sorry.
If they own the connection and they own Facebook, they'll just have more information about you to sell.
Yeah, well, no doubt. I don't know what Facebook doesn't know about me already. It'd be kind of frightening. Same with Google. But if they found a way to make revenue that wasn't, say, specifically pairing my information with a buyer, maybe they'd be less inclined to do so. And if not, then, well, you know, unfortunately, I've already given them license to sell me. when I made an account, unfortunately. Or fortunately, depending on how you look at it.
Well, we've had some great discussions, and I would love to keep going, but we're getting close to the end of our time, and I don't want to run through all of our time without having a chance to hear from Dave about the Geek Inn. Now, Dave, I will be honest. I've been rushing around, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet. So can you give us a little hint about what you wrote about in this week's Geek Inn?
Yeah, it's not quite up yet either, actually, so don't apologize. But it's about a fantastic breakthrough in 3D printing. Since it's Halloween, it seems more than appropriate to talk about hearts and beating hearts and replacing hearts. And in this case, what it is Carnegie Mellon has made a breakthrough using a regular off-the-shelf 3D printer in printing living tissue. And what the breakthrough is up to this point, printing soft tissue has been incredibly difficult to do because, as you know, 3D printing is better to be described as additive printing, right? Something is printed at a layer, another layer is added, and another layer is added until you have a finished product. The problem with doing that with an organ like a kidney or a heart or any other sort of soft thing is that it can't hold its own weight while you add layers to it. So we have made 3D printed organs in the past, including kidneys. Ears are another common one. But they cost over $100,000 to make the printer that does this because they need to create an extremely complicated structure that also has a frame around it for the organ to even survive, right? So Carnegie Mellon has been able to print an organ using a $2,000 printer. And the way they do it is fascinating. They've created a gel that they put in place first, and then the 3D printer injects the material inside this gel. And the gel gives it just enough support that the material stays where it's been injected while it's adding layers. And then all they do is put this gel and the new organ inside into warm water. And the gel melts away, and behind it is the organ, complete and ready to go. Now, what they have not yet done, because this is complicated, is they've not yet combined the process of making soft tissue with living tissue. So what they've now done is they've made things out of collagen and other materials our organs are made from. And there's an existing process that people have used to 3D print organs. And now they need to marry those two to create living tissue with this process. And if they do, it promises a relatively cheap replacement part industry to help with our society that is simply does not have enough organs for the number of people who need them because of the diseases that are ravaging their bodies.
Well, I think this sounds mighty cool, and I'm going to echo words used by a blogger who happens to be a law professor at the University of Tennessee, Glenn Reynolds, when he says, "Faster, please." I think that the faster we can get this technology out of labs and into hospitals and research facilities worldwide, the better off we're going to be. This is good stuff.
Yeah, I think so. I think it offers the potential that we could essentially create replacement parts for ourselves, much like you do for the engine of your car, and it creates the idea, not necessarily of immortality, because there are cell breakdown issues and all sorts of things, but it creates the idea that chronic illness may be a thing of the past. So I think the first thing people think immediately is, somebody who's waiting for a heart transplant gets one, yay. And that's wonderful, right? We have about 80 people a day who die on the transplant list every day waiting for an organ. That's wonderful. But it actually creates a new demand for organs for people who have chronic illnesses that aren't necessarily sick enough to get on the transplant list, but who spend every day in taking, you know, dozens of drugs or in painful rehab or in discomfort because they're not sick enough to be on the transplant list, but they're sure as heck sick enough that they don't feel good. And if you can replace organs on a level where you're no longer having to trade a tragic loss for a victory that someone else is going to be alive, if you're now just rebuilding those organs from scratch, you're in a situation where you can treat disease differently. You can start thinking about cure rather than treatment. And so it opens this up to tens of thousands of people who otherwise couldn't think about a transplant.
Well, I, for one, am looking forward to the replacement for the pancreas. I think that would be a lovely thing.
As someone who
has been on the receiving end of conversations regarding organ transplant lists, I think that being able to replace the whole waiting for someone to die process would be a mighty, mighty fine thing.
Definitely.
So I recommend that everyone go out and read The Geek In and get a little inspiration after all the gloomy talk we've had here on Information Week Live this week.
Plus, we're still talking about beating hearts, so that's all, you know, ookie-gookie Halloween stuff.
Oh, cool.
And it will be live soon, by the way, so sorry, folks, if don't rush off to try and read it yet because it's not up, but it will be.
Very good. Well, this has been another great episode with some very good conversation. So I'd like to go around the table, thank my fellow panel members, and find out what's coming up for the next week for you. Now, Susan, I know that you are busy enough keeping an eye on everything that happens at Information Week that you don't get to write as much as we'd like to see. You are, in fact, a very gifted writer, but what is going on at Information Week in the coming week that you think people should know about?
Well, I think, you know, we're going to have some coverage of Google's decision to merge Chrome and Android and what that is going to look like, and we're going to have some reaction to that. We're also going to be having a commentary piece around all of the news concerning Oracle's efforts to make a play for the cloud space. And our cloud expert, Charlie Babcock, who's been a guest on this show before, will be delving into that for a piece next week on just what the implications are and what it's going to mean for the enterprise and for the cloud market in general.
Outstanding. Well, we will certainly look forward to that. And I know that you tend to let people know about what's going on at Information Week through the various social media channels. If people were looking for you on the Tweety Pipes, where would they find you?
You can find me personally at Susan Nunziata. And also, I do pipe into the at Information Week Twitter feed as well.
Outstanding. Well, thank you so much for taking time from a busy schedule to join us this afternoon.
Thanks. My pleasure.
And Dave, when you're not looking at ookie gookie Halloween stuff, I know that you keep your eye on a ton of things around the industry. So what should we be looking for from you in the coming week?
Yeah, today that came out our ookie gookie scariest bosses slideshow. If you haven't seen that yet, that's a lot of fun. The 10 traits of bosses that scare people the most, and some advice on how to maybe have those bosses not be so scary. And on Sunday, I've got a fun special on alternatives to the desk, to the sitting desk. We've got a lot of fun things on that. And coming up next week, I'm going to have a review of the 15 most sought-after freelance skills in IT. I think people should really be excited to see that, see if they're up to snuff or whether they need to go learn some new skills to be more hireable. Should be a good week coming up.
Outstanding. Well, we will look forward to all that. We'll also look forward to keeping up with you on social media. How can people do that?
At GeekEndDave on Twitter, and you can catch me at Information Week and allanalytics.com.
Outstanding. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Dave.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I've got several things coming up. I just had a piece that went live, I think, yesterday. I got to interview SAP's CEO, Bill McDermott, so would love to have you check that out. I've got another Information Week Elite 100 profile coming up, and all sorts of things as I get ready to dive into some more free and open source stuff, as well as some development topics in the coming week or two. To find out about all of those, you can follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA, and if you like little short irreverent videos about IT and frankly other stuff, feel free to follow me on Periscope at that same handle at KG4GWA. Well, again, my thanks to my panel members, Dave Wagner and Susan Nunziata, and thanks as always to you for being here with us. If you're with us live at 3 p.m. on Friday, then you can take part in the online chat that accompanies this show. If not, we hope you enjoy us on the streaming version of this show, which is available on demand 24 hours a day. Coming soon will be available in podcast form. More news about that in the coming week. Well, for all of us here at Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. Hey, we'll see you next time.